This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Do you all understand? The brother of the Chushin wrote a sefer called the Kuntra Sasfekas. It's recorded already. And in the introduction to the Kuntra Sasfekas, which is actually printed at the back of the Kuntra Sasfekas, he mentions there that that if a human being were able to elevate himself up to Shamayim, and he were able to see the beauty of everything that takes place in heaven, his real pleasure would not occur until he came back to earth and was able to share his experience with others. The real pleasure is in sharing the experience. Merely having the experience is not enough. And that's why when people travel overseas, they take movie cameras and things, not just for their own memories. It's very seldom that you sit and you look at your own pictures. Despite all the money one invests in photographic equipment, it's very seldom that you actually sit down and look at all the old videos and the old movies. In the old days, certainly, when they used to have these cine things and it was a big thing to put it up, every family had their piles of cines of the children and everything, but nobody really looked at them. But why do people do it? Because at Bishas Meister, they think to themselves how nice it will be to show and to talk about and to... The pleasure of life cannot be lived in a vacuum. The pleasure of life needs to be lived with communication, with sharing those pleasures. That's when they really become pleasures. Rabbi Nguyen says the same thing. The Kuntra Sasfekas brings that Rabbi Nguyen also, that when one goes through a wonderful experience, it creates within one an enormous drive to communicate about it, to share it, to tell people about it. That's one of the gifts that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us, that we are not limited to our own experiences, that we are able to share the experiences of others, and that others want us to share those experiences. Other things, it's a little bit difficult. Imagine if the Ribbono Shel Olam did it in such a way that not everybody had a little bit like they did in the kibbutzim in the old days. Not everybody had a fridge. Share the fridge. One person will have a fridge, and one person will have an oven, and one person will have a motor car, and one person will have and share, manage. It wouldn't be such a good society. There would be a lot of trouble. There would be a lot of difficulty. So there, the Ribbono Shel Olam in the physical world makes it so that everybody has their own mind. But when it comes to simchas and to joy and to pleasure, there the Ribbono Shel Olam makes it so that people want to share their pleasures. Their frigidaires they don't want to share. Their motor cars they don't want to share. Their stoves and ovens they don't want to share. But their experiences they do want to share. And that's a wonderful thing in life. The fact that people want to share their experiences, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam made us capable of sharing our experiences, makes the possibility of pleasure limitless. If we open ourselves to sharing the pleasures of others, then we're not limited to our own experience. We can share pleasures of other people too. That's sympathizing and empathizing with people.
Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz throws that concept into contradistinction with a medrash in this week's Sedra. Very well-known medrash that I've spoken about several times before from different angles. Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. There was a story with Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. Shebo Erev Shabbos, Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta was extremely poor. And it's a pity in a way that we don't know today, in our society, we don't know what poverty really is. Do you think poverty is if a person can't pay his accounts at the end of the month? Do you think poverty is if a person can't afford to pay his school fees? Do you think poverty is if a person's only got one suit of clothes? And we don't really know what poverty is. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafto came Erev Shabbos, beloy hoyolo man lis parnes, and he had nothing to eat for Shabbos. What do you think he used to eat for Shabbos generally? How much does the chicken cost, Moshe? How much does the chicken cost now? $4.99. A kilo. So they didn't used to eat chicken at $4.99. He used to eat challah and a little a shear of wine, a revius of wine, and a piece of herring, probably, maybe a tiny piece of meat to be mekayim the mitzvah of meat. That must have been all that he ate. So all in all, his Shabbos would have cost him and his Rebbetzin would have cost, who knows, 2-3 rand. His Shabbos would have cost him. But he didn't have the 2 or 3 rand. He was a great rov. Do you think the community wouldn't have paid him? Why didn't he have money? He wouldn't take. He wouldn't accept that. That was out of the question. Not for his Torah. His Torah was for nothing. What could he do? It's coming Shabbos.
There's nothing to eat. So he's not worried about going hungry, because then he would have done the same on Thursday, Wednesday. Hungry, to be hungry, well, alright, one can live hungry also. He's worried about the mitzvah of Shabbos. How can one have a Shabbos without challah, without wine?
So he goes out of town, and he spalled with Neo Elohim, and he davened before the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Nisan lo yevon tovah min hashamayim,
and the precious stone came down to him from heaven.
Nasna lo shulchani, he went and gave it to the banker, Shabbos, and he was able to buy enough food for that Shabbos.
When he came home, his Rebbetzin said to him, Reb Shimon, where does this come from all of a sudden? What happened? He says, what does it bother you? The Ribbono Shel Olam provided. He says, you want to eat Shabbos? That's fine. But if you expect me to join you at the table, you tell me where the food comes from, otherwise I don't eat. San Rebbetzin, she was.
He began to tell her the story. He said to her, Kach nispalalti lifnei Elohim, adavim before Hashem, v'nitan li min ha-shamayim, it was given to me from heaven. She said to him, eini te'emes klum. What would our Rebbetzin say nowadays? They'd say, come, tell me the truth.
Stone came from heaven. That was no problem. She understood the stone came from heaven. That didn't pose any difficulty to her. She said, the only problem is I'm not accepting it. That's it. Ribbono Shel Olam wants to give us presents. That's very nice of him. I'm not accepting it.
Ad shetoymali shetachziru moitzei Shabbos, on one condition: if you'll give it back after Shabbos. Again, didn't even bother her how he was going to give it back.
How do you give it back? That the stone should come down from heaven. The force of gravity, one can understand somehow that it comes down. How are you going to get it back? That's not her problem. He must find a way. That's his responsibility.
Amalolama, he says, why? All this discussion was going on Erev Shabbos. The two of them are desperately hungry. Time is running out. It's nearly Shabbos and the food has to be prepared. And they're having a philosophic debate now. Why? What's wrong? Why won't you accept the food? Amaloi atarotze shiyehe shulchon chochosa v'shulchon chaver chomale. Do you want to come to Ilam Habo and find that your table is lacking and your friend's table is got? Rabbi Shimon didn't know what to do. How to handle such a Rebbe, such a Rebbetzin. So he went to Rebbe. Omar lo, lechem lo. Rebbe said to Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, go and tell her as follows. Im shulchon chochaser, ani amalenu mishuli. If there's anything you're missing in Olam Haba, you come to me and I'll make it up for you. I assure you, you won't be missing anything. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta was happy, now everything's sorted out. She'll accept the food, they'll have a nice Shabbos, and everything's fine. Holach v'omar lo. He went and told her. Amru lo, she said to him, Lech imi l'mishim milimedech l'toyro. Take me to your Rebbe. Who's been teaching you Torah? Is that the kind of Torah you've been learning? You take me to your Rebbe. Let me have a word with him. All this Erev Shabbos. Amru lo, Rebbe. She said to him, Rebbe, v'chi roye odom l'chaveiro l'ilam habo? Tell me, Rebbe. Who says we're going to find you up there? Who says we're going to find you? Do we see one another up there? Local tzaddik, the tzaddik have a oilam, but the atma, isn't every tzaddik his own oilam, his own world? Shenemar, as it says, ki hoilech ha'odom el beis oilamot. For man shall go to the house of his universe, of his world. Oilamim en kesif kan, el oilamot. It doesn't say to his world, it says to his world. Ivan sheshoma kein. And Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta heard that argument. Holach behechti.
he went and gave the stone back. So he did.
Beautiful story. And the story very difficult to understand. Previously we've discussed the relationship of the precious stone to the Olam Haba and all that kind of thing. But Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz points out on the basis of this medrash that joy and pleasure of sharing experiences is unique to this world. In Olam Haba, with all its pleasures, one pleasure it doesn't have. And that's the pleasure of sharing nachas with others. Of sharing simchas, of sharing nachas, of sharing good news, of sharing joy. That it doesn't have. That's only in this world. And the Chaim Shmuel goes on to talk about how important it is to make full use of it, to enjoy it, because that's not something we've got forever. But that needs to be intellectually understood, and the Chaim Shmuel doesn't explain it. What does this mean, called tzaddik? That every tzaddik is a world on his own and that there is no communication between the tzaddikim. What does that mean? I was working on this medrash today and found an analysis of Rabbi Tzvi Petzburger, and it is so perfect that there's nothing one can add to it and there's nothing better that one can do. Even if one could, it's rather important that you should know this Rabbi Tzvi Petzburger. And certainly one cannot add to the clarity of this analysis of the Medrash. And I suggest that you still have the Chazorah groups. That you go through it inside. You can photo status and go through it inside afterwards. In our kind of lives, there is no recognition for effort. If I call in a workman and ask him to quote me on repairing an appliance, he says the spare parts will be 50 rand and the labour will be 100 rand. It costs you 150 rand plus tax. He comes and he does the job and he gives me the bill. The bill's for 450 rand. I say, why 450 rand? Did you use extra parts that you didn't plan on using? He says, no. But you can't imagine how hard it was for me. I wasn't feeling well that day, and my children had to go and see the doctor, and all sorts of things that I had, and that day my wife went into hospital, and for me to come was so hard, you can't imagine how difficult it was. I want 450 rand for my efforts, much harder than I thought it would be. I said, look, fellow, that's none of my business how hard it was. I wanted a job done, and you quoted me for the job, that's the end of the story. I don't reward you for effort. I pay you for the job. So life has its difficulties, and that's it. But not so with the Ribbono Shel. With the Ribbono Shel, we have the principle of Lefum Tzaro Igro. A very peculiar concept. That the Ribbono Shel rewards not only in accordance with the magnitude of the mitzvah. That's an objective definition of reward. There is a certain reward set aside for every mitzvah. But there's another factor altogether which is thrown into the reward, and that is the factor of lefum tzaro igro. In addition to the objective reward for the particular mitzvah, there is also reward for the effort and the energy, for the difficulty, the hardship involved in doing the mitzvah. And that varies from circumstance to circumstance, from person to person. That's the subjective element in reward. So the reward package, The financial package, as they call it, that the Ribbono Shel Olam makes up for the individual, is made up of two factors. On the one hand, one is rewarded for the objective doing of the mitzvah, so much for this mitzvah, so much for that mitzvah. And in addition to that, every individual is rewarded in accordance with the effort it was for him to perform that mitzvah under the particular circumstances in which he performed it. And then, of course, it's commensurate with the tzar. The more there is difficulty in performing the mitzvah, the more is the schar for the mitzvah. So you can take an ordinary mitzvah, the person puts tefillin onto his arm, it's not a difficult mitzvah to do. But if for one person it is very difficult to do, his arm is in terrible pain, or he hasn't got a pair of tefillin, and he's got to travel a long way to find a kosher pair of tefillin, he goes and he schleps, it's a long business. He gets reward for that mitzvah that is far in excess of the reward
that everybody else gets. And there is, in fact, a formula that gives you some idea of the relationship between the reward for a mitzvah performed in comfort and the reward for a mitzvah performed in hardship. The Ovis de Rabbi Nosson says, Toiv loy la'odom dovor echod betza'ar mimeya dvorim berevach. One word of Torah learnt in difficulty, in pain, is worth 100 learnt in comfort. So performing a mitzvah in difficulty is worth 100 mitzvahs. That's the relationship. Now with this concept, Vitzler explains the pshat in the Gemara, which is often quoted but not often understood. The Gemara says, "Bavasu defayin ches al kein yomru hamushlim," where it says in the Torah, the Moishlim, the rulers will come and they will say, let us come to Cheshbon. That's the simple reading of the verse. But the Gemara learns it differently. Alkein Yomru HaMoishlim, Elu HaMoishlim BeYitzron. Who is a Moishel? Who is a ruler? A person who rules over his own character. A master of his character. Boyu Cheshbon, what does it mean? Come to Cheshbon. Boyu V'nachshuv Cheshbonu Shalom. It means, let us make a Cheshbon. Let us make an account. What kind of account is the Gemara? Hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro, uschar aveiro keneged efsedo. Listen to that phrase carefully, because we're going to analyze it in detail. It's a theorem and its converse. First one, hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro. The loss of a mitzvah weighed up against its reward. Uschar aveiro keneged efsedo. And the reward of a transgression of an avero against its loss. The simple meaning is, before you do a mitzvah, while you're hesitating to do a mitzvah, make a calculation. What does it cost you to do the mitzvah? And what is the reward? And put them in a balance, and you'll see very quickly that it's a good investment. Really, business is a very simple thing. If something is worth more than it costs, you buy it. There's no such thing as you don't have money for it. If it's really worth more than it costs, you'll find plenty of people who'll invest with you, who'll lend you the money, or who'll go partnership with you. If it's really worth more, nobody hesitates. You've just got to be sure that it's takaze, so you need to balance it up very carefully. But if you look in the paper, and the price of gold is $400 an ounce, and a person comes and he brings you a block of gold, and he says, this is 10 ounces. So you make a quick calculation, and you say, $400 an ounce, 10 ounces, that means $4,000. How much do you want for it? He says, $3,000, cash. So where's the catch? Maybe it's not real gold, or maybe it's not 10 ounces, but that's your only sophic. So you have it assayed, and you find it is real gold, 24 carats. And you put it on the balance, and you find it's 10 ounces exactly. What do you do? Still say, give me a day to think about it. What's a shayla? You know what it's worth. You know it costs less than it's worth. You go ahead, finish. So make a cheshbon whenever you're weighing up to do a mitzvah, not to do a mitzvah. Why wouldn't you do it? Everybody wants to do mitzvahs. Well, it's difficult. There's cost involved. Good. Figure out the cost. Figure out the benefits. Put them in the scale and make your decision. And likewise with an Aveira, nobody wants to do an Aveira. Why do we do it? Because it pays sometimes. It feels good, or there's benefits in it. It's fine. Says the Gemara, we're not contesting that. Not saying that sometimes it doesn't pay to be dishonest, that it doesn't pay to do all sorts of bad things. It pays. Sure it pays. The only question is, how much does it pay? So figure that out before you go. People say crime doesn't pay. Of course crime pays. It pays very well. But you've got to work it out. It's payment in terms of its cost. So put it in the scale, how much you'll make out of it, and figure out how much it costs, and you'll see very quickly that it's not a good business deal. And use a simple business cop to keep out of it. That's how it needs to be done. That's the simple meaning of the pasuk. But says Rabbi Tzila, so what's the chiddush? That's very obvious. You don't need the Gemara to tell you that. That's basics. Explains Rabbi Tzila, hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro, means that there's hefsed in a mitzvah, there's loss in doing a mitzvah. What's the loss? The effort, the pain, suffering. If there was no cost in doing a mitzvah, we would all do mitzvahs all day long. There's nobody in the world, not a Jew, not a Gentile, nobody in the world who wouldn't like to do mitzvahs if it didn't cost anything. The only reason that we don't do mitzvahs all the time is because they cost. So every mitzvah has a cost. Take the cost, says Rav Itzel of Pesaburger, and balance that hefsed mitzvah, the cost of the mitzvah, keneged schoro, not against the rewards for the mitzvah, but the rewards for the cost of the mitzvah. There are two rewards, you remember we said. There's a direct reward for the mitzvah itself, that's the objective reward. But there's also a subjective quantification of reward. You are rewarded for the very cost. So you'll come out the taka, the more it's costing you, the more it's worth. And you should find great pleasure. You should run after those mitzvahs which cost you more. Those are the ones to really go for from a business point of view. Because the more it costs you, the bigger the ratio of returns. You get extra schar for that. So what do? That's the chiddush of the Gemara, says Rabbi Tzvi. Normally all we do is we do it the simple way. As I first said, take the rewards for the mitzvah, the cost of the mitzvah, you weigh it up and you do the mitzvah. But there's something else. When we're choosing mitzvahs, and it's a question of what do I put my energies into, there's certain mitzvahs I tend to leave aside because they're difficult. Here you're missing the point, says Rabbi Tzvi. Have said mitzvah, keneged schoro, sure they're difficult. But if you weigh up the rewards you get for that very difficulty, you'll see how enormous it is. See, sometimes somebody will suggest an investment in a particular business, and the potential investor will say no. They'll say, but why not? You can get 10 times your money back in 2 years. He says, yeah, but the risks are too high. So he's told, but that's why you can get your money back in 2 years. If the risks weren't high, you wouldn't get your money back in 2 years, 10 times over. But what would happen if the risk is high in a chinami, but he gets a bank guarantee as well? That you can't lose. Your investment you won't lose. Plus, if everything goes well, you'll get ten times. Would anybody doubt then that the value of the investment? And if there was a bank guarantee that you'll get to tuck it as a risk, that you'll get your 10 times even with the risk. That's the kind of business we're involved in here. It looks absurd. It looks too good to be true. Where the bigger the cost of a mitzvah, the higher the ratio of returns on that particular mitzvah. So when we're looking at it, if we have a mitzvah to do, what we should seek to do is the mitzvah with the most tzar involved. The mitzvah with the most tzar will yield the best rewards. That's what we should do. What about the converse? Schar aveiro keneged hefsedo, how does that work? Here we have a difficulty. If we'll say the schar aveiro, you get rewarded, you must weigh up the reward of the aveiro, the pleasure of the aveiro, against its loss. What does that mean? There's a bit to it. Firstly, we have a principle that just as you're rewarded for mitzvahs in accordance with the tzar, the more tzar involved, the harder the mitzvah, the more the reward. So when it comes to aveiros, so when it comes to transgressions, the harder it is to withstand the temptation, the greater is the reward for withstanding the temptation. That's a natural consequence. Obviously, that's one step further than the funtzar igro. Not doing an aveiro is also a mitzvah. So the harder it is not to do it, the greater is the reward for not doing it. So, for example, not to be mechalel Shabbos for most frum people is not very difficult to do, in the normal sense of the word. Not to turn the light on Shabbos. Not so difficult not to turn the light on Shabbos. So there's no extra reward for that. Because there's no big yetzer hara. But not to talk a word of lashon hara, that's like a hard. And for that there's enormous reward. To control your mouth, to keep your mouth closed, for that there's enormous reward. Because of lefum tzar o'igra. The reward, not only the reward for the mitzvah is commensurate with the tzar, but the reward for abstaining from an aveiro is also commensurate with the tzar for that abstinence. But Rabbi Tzvi says that's very interesting, because if you take that a step further, then you've got to say the punishment for those aveiros which are hard to withstand is less than the punishment for those aveiros which are easy to withstand. Right? That would also be logical. So, now there you turn the light on the Shabbos, the Rebbe Shem has a big time on you. But you don't even have a Yetzirah. What was the difficulty? Why did you have to do it? What reason? Why did you have to do it? So for that there's a heavy punishment. But for an Avera, we really got such a big Yetzirah. The Rebbeinu Shem understand that was hard. The punishment is a little bit less. It says Rebbe Tzvi, that comes out weird. Take something like Arias. Take something like people, now the in word in Washington is womanizing. So say that the person's got a Yetzirah for womanizing. Big Yetzirah. So what are we going to say? He doesn't get much punishment for it. Well, big Yetzirah, what can you do? Gezel. Theft. The Gemara says, Gezel the Arias, big Yetzirah for it. Theft. Theft doesn't mean putting your hands in somebody else's till necessarily. Theft means taking anything which according to Shulchan Aruch doesn't belong to you. So any business practice which yields to halachically incorrect profits is called theft. And there's a big Yetzirah to be dishonest in business. So what is that going to mean? That we're not going to get much punishment for it because there's a big Yetzirah? It doesn't seem right. There's something wrong somewhere. Now the Ritzler goes a step further and with that it becomes clear. And he says, in just the same way as we are rewarded for the pain of mitzvah, so we are punished for the pleasure of Avera. Just as in mitzvah there is an objective and a subjective reward, there's an objective reward for this particular mitzvah, but in addition to that there's the subjective quantification of reward for the amount of suffering you experience as an individual in this particular circumstance to perform that particular mitzvah. On the other hand, contrary-wise, in the case of Avera, it works exactly the opposite. Avera, there is an objective punishment for each Avera. For Chilul Shabbos, this is what it is. For dishonesty in business, this is what it is. For Arayas, this is what it is. Each thing has its objective punishment. And true in the objective punishment may be those Averas where we have a strong Yetzirah, there's less objective punishment than in others. But there's another aspect of the punishment. We're also punished for the pleasure of the Avera. The more there's pleasure in Avera, the greater the punishment. So it's true, the objective quantification of a punishment such as Arias is womanizing, good. He gets a horror, what can you do? But for the pleasure of it, he has to pay as well. That's why the Belia points out some interesting halachas. The halacha is that if a woman is betrothed but not yet married, and she commits adultery, betrothed doesn't mean engaged. Betrothed means the first half of the chuppah ceremony. She's got a ring on her finger already. And at that point, she commits adultery, because in the old days there was a year between that stage of the marriage and the next stage. Then she gets the death sentence. But which of the four death sentences does she get? She gets skila, which is stoning, which is the worst of the death sentences. If she's married already, if it's after the chuppah altogether, sheva brachos and everything, then she gets chenek. Chenek is the lightest of the four death sentences. All death sentences are light, is perhaps not the correct word to use in relationship to a death sentence, but it's the least severe of the four death sentences. After skilo, there's hereg, there's serefo, there's guillotine, and there's pouring molten lead down the throat. There are all sorts of unpleasant things. Chenek is strangulation, but it's done very subtly. The rope with which the person is strangled is still covered in cotton wool, so it shouldn't hurt his neck. It's done very with great delicacy and finesse. Chenek. So of the four death sentences, skilo is the worst, and chenek is the least severe. When she's only betrothed, she gets skilo. When she's married already, proper, then she only gets chenek. Logical. Should be the other way around. When she's half married, then she should get the lighter form. When she's fully married, she should get the worst form. Says Rebellia. When she's half married, she's not living with her husband yet. She lives at home. When she's fully married, she's living with her husband. So when she's half married, while she's busy committing adultery, she has no fear that the husband might walk in. Because then he's got no business being there. But once she's married, at the very moment that she's committing adultery, at the back of her mind is the fear of her husband. And that fear is part of the punishment already. It's already lessened. It's a bit of tzar. So the first woman, the woman who's only betrothed, enjoys the adultery more because she's got less to lose in a sense. There's less fear. for that pleasure she pays with the additional death sentence. She gets skila. The woman who's married enjoys it a little bit less, so her punishment is a little bit less. Look how meduyak the Ribbono Shel Olam is, how precise he is with the punishments in accordance with the crime. Not in accordance with the crime, but in accordance of the enjoyment of the crime. Another example Reb Elia gives is the person who steals and slaughters cattle. Very serious, because cattle was a person's source of income. It was much worse to steal cattle than to steal anything else. But there was a difference. If he stole a lamb, then he only paid 4 times the value of the lamb. Whereas if he stole an ox or a cow, he paid 5 times the value of the ox or the cow. Why the difference? Explain the same thing. A person steals a lamb. How does he steal the lamb? What does he do with the lamb? He puts it on his shoulder and he goes. And when he steals a cow or an ox, what does he do? He leads it. He can't put it on his shoulder. He leads it. What's more covetic? To walk down the road leading an ox, or to walk down the road with a lamb on your shoulder? Clearly, okay, to walk down the road leading an ox is more covetic. So who enjoys the aveiro less? The one who's stealing a cow, or the one who's stealing a sheep, a lamb? The one who's stealing the lamb enjoys it less, so he gets less of a punishment. So the same concept that Reb Itzler speaks about, don't forget, Reb Itzler was a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter, and Reb Elia was a Talmud of Reb Simcha Zisler, who was also a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanter, so it's all the same school. The punishment is commensurate with the enjoyment of the crime. You're punished not only for the performance of the crime, but also for the enjoyment of the crime. In that case, we have a bit of an understanding already of our Midrash. Learning Torah B'Tzar, the Ovesta Rabbi Nosson says, is 100 times more valuable than learning it in comfort. Learning it in hardship is 100 times more valuable than learning it in comfort. Rebbe was very wealthy. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafto was very poor. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafto gets a precious stone Erev Shabbos, and he spends it on his Shabbos, and he brings the Shabbos home, the Shabbos food home. His wife isn't prepared to accept it. Why not? What's she worried about? The normal understanding of the Medrash is she's worried that this is part of her Olam Haba, that she's being paid in this world for something which really should be set aside for the world to come. She doesn't want to take it in monetary currency. She wants it in the currency of Olam Haba. But we're learning her disapproval differently this evening. What she was worried about was that she would now be deprived, she and her husband would be deprived of the opportunity to learn Torah B'tzar, to learn Torah in hardship. If it comes by normal means, one goes and one manages and money comes in, good, then that is the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if one doesn't, if by normal means one is living in abject poverty, and through miraculous means, super miraculous means, out of the blue, literally, comes this money, that means I'm going to be deprived of that ratio. Whatever Torah my husband's going to learn this Shabbos is going to be worth only 1/100th of what he learned last Shabbos. Why? Because of the money we got this. I don't want it. It's more important to me that there should be more value in the Torah that he learns, that there should be more value in the mitzvahs that he learns, that's more important to me than that there should be comfort. The Kiddush wine, we'll find Kiddush wine. Are we going to sit in a cold, miserable little hovel and we're going to say Kiddush in an empty apartment with no food on the table, maybe a dry piece of bread for challah, and we're going to be saying Kiddush knowing that there's no fish coming, there's no soup coming, there's no meat coming, there's no vegetables coming, there's no dessert coming, and no cup of tea and no cake afterwards. Nothing is coming. And we're going to have to sit there and say Kiddush. Says Mrs. Rabbi Shimon, but that Kiddush is worth 100 times any other Kiddush. What would I rather have, that Kiddush, or the Kiddush where you're sitting in comfort? I've been singled out, she says. My husband and I have been singled out to be able to produce a Kiddush that is more precious than anybody else's Kiddush. Because we're living in such unbelievable poverty. And you want to deprive us of the ability to achieve such enormity with our mitzvahs? Says Rebbe, don't worry, Rebbetzin. Whatever you're missing, I'll make up. says Rebbetzin Shimon ben Chalafta, I don't believe you can. Why not? Because everybody is their own Olam. What does that mean, everybody is their own Olam? Explains Rebbetzin Petterburger. No two people live in the same circumstances. We all do the same mitzvahs. And for that mitzvah, our reward, our objective reward is all equal. We all stand and put on tefillin. We get reward for it. If the tefillin are all kosher tefillin, we all say the bracha nicely with kavona. The objective reward, we all get the same. But the difficulty with which each person is performing that mitzvah varies from person to person. And no two people are performing even the same mitzvah with the same degree of mesilas nefesh. Each person is different in the world on his own. Which means the reward, the subjective reward, differs from every individual to every individual. There are no two individuals who are being rewarded the same way. And therefore, says Mrs. Rebbetzin Shimon ben Chalafta, Rebbe, you're a wealthy man. I know you're a bigger tzaddik than my husband. I know you're a bigger lamdan than my husband. You're the Nossi, after all. You're the Godul Hadur. I know there's nobody in our generation that can come to your ankles, Rebbe. But I also know something else. You're going to have a lot of schar in Olam Habo. You're going to have a tremendous reward in Olam Habo. I have no doubt about that. But I do know that you and I won't have a common language in Olam Habo. Because the quality of your reward is going to be different to ours. We're going to have that special, unique reward of keeping Torah inside. And you won't have that. So you'll give me some of yours, but it won't be mine. I'll be using yours, you won't be able to give me properly what is mine. Now we were talking at our table today of what happens. A person goes overseas for a year, for 2 years. Comes back and finds that people he used to be very close to, and even people he's corresponded with in between, finds all of a sudden a certain distance. Been away for a couple of years, there's a distance. What is it? It's an amazing thing. I remember as a child, I used to find it even coming home from yeshiva. Been away from a year, I used to find coming home even to my own parents and brothers and sister. The first couple of days, a difficulty in communication. We've been writing to each other regularly. We loved each other no less than we had before. So a certain difficulty took a few days to overcome. Why? Because as an individual goes through experiences different to those which are being experienced by his friend, there becomes less and less to share. We need some common denominator in order to communicate. We need to be talking the same language. There needs to be something on which we're basing the communication. We need to know what each other is about. But you take somebody from a completely different background and you bring in two people with completely different backgrounds, where is the common ground for communication? How can they feel one another? How can they identify with one another if they don't understand each other's experiences? And as people branch off into different types of lives, that becomes more and more. People who become Baalei Teshuva experience the same things. They keep up a relationship with friends who have not become Baalei Teshuva. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, after a while, there's very little in common. You can still sit down occasionally, have a nice and pleasant evening, but it's not what it used to be. You used to be able to laugh about the same things, worry about the same things, argue about the same things. Now somehow what occupies their mind is not what occupies your mind, and there's a barrier. One gets all worried about it, but it's natural. One's experiences are different to the other person. And it's very difficult to share, to identify, and to empathize with somebody who has no sharing at all of common experience. And Rebbetzin Shimon ben Chalafta says that to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rebbe, she says, there's no communication up there. Not because there's soundproof barriers between us, but because we're all worlds on our own. Our experiences are so unique that there's no way that we can really understand one another. Down on this world, a lot of our experiences are similar. We all have to earn a living, and we all have to daven shachris mincha and ma'ariv, and we all have a Shabbos together, and our routines are very similar after all. So we have what to talk about. We have what to relate to one another on. But up there where we're extracting and we're living on the fine, rarefied atmosphere of the product of our own spiritual experience, and each one's spiritual experience differs because lefum tsar oigro, our olam haba is constituted not only by the reward for the objective mitzvahs that we have done, but it is constituted also by the reward for the subjective difficulty in the mitzvahs, and there each one has his own world. There's no communication, there's no place for communication. There's a barrier between us. That's the loneliness of olam haba. Not because communication is barred or banned or prohibited, but because communication is just very difficult when everybody has such a unique experience that it's very hard to share it with anybody else.
We take that idea further. Ritzada asks, in that case, the development of individuality and uniqueness in Olam Habo is dependent on Tsar. If everybody's living comfortably, then we'll get to Olam Habo and we're all going to be carbon copies of one another. Because we all do more or less the same mitzvahs. So we're all going to be very close to one another. The way we become unique in our Avodas Hashem is not by making a new religion, by creating new mitzvahs, by deleting other mitzvahs. That's not the way we become unique. That method of uniqueness is barred to us. We've all got the same Shulchan Aruch, we've all got the same Gemara, we've all got the same halachas. Where's our uniqueness in Avodas Hashem? Even in Kavon is good, so people say each one can put his own Kavona into it. Fine. But that's also fairly standard. We all know what our Kavonas are meant to be, that we're serving the Ribbono Shlom for the sake of the Ribbono Shlom and only for the... Basically, it's all the same. So where is each individual going to find expression of his own unique personality within Avodas Hashem? The answer we've learned is in Tzara, the way we cope with hardship, because each of our hardships differs. There's no two people who have the same hardship. It's important to know, by the way, that everybody has hardship. It's one of the faults of human beings to think each person thinks that they're the only ones with hardship, with difficulties. It's important to know that everybody has difficulties. When I came back from yeshiva and I went down to Stellenbosch a few months after I started there, I got married and Serena came down and I introduced her to the whole community, which didn't take very long. And we went around to all their homes. It was very cute. And she said one evening, she thinks it's time we went back to Johannesburg. Or somewhere else. So I said, why? You're homesick? No, she says, it's beautiful here, it's lovely here, but there's nothing to do. So I said, what do you mean there's nothing to do? She says, such lovely families. Nobody has any problems here. What are you going to do? To start a yeshiva here, you're not. To paskin major shilas here, you're not. So what are you here for? To help people, to see people, to sort them through, to solve their problems, to counsel. Who needs you? They're all well adjusted, they're all balanced, there are no pressures, it's a beautiful place, lovely environment, lovely atmosphere, every family is healthy. You need to go somewhere where the people are a bit meshuggah in there, you'll have some work to do. So I can't walk out in the middle of a contract there, so this, and we're enjoying it, it's lovely, just that she feels there's nothing to do there. I don't think it was 3 months later, by which time every family there, it was as if it was the Yad Hashem, unbelievable. Every family had had a major crisis within the next couple of months. And then she realized, you never know what goes on. And no family knew that the other family was going through a crisis, except in one case it was a public affair, it was a public matter. But in all the others, nobody except the family and we knew that they were going through that crisis. That's how it is. Everybody thinks they're the only ones under pressure. They are the only ones in crisis. It's not so. That's how life is. And the more one demands of oneself, and the higher one sets standards of oneself, and the more one takes on for oneself, the tougher the pressures. And the difference between people is not in how much pressure and how much hardship. Sure, there are situations where a person is hit by enormous difficulty and enormous tragedy and enormous hardship. That happens. Certainly that happens. But normally, that's not the normal case. Baruch Hashem, most people live what appears from the outside to be a normal sort of life. As a Rav, I'll tell you that there's no such thing as a normal sort of life. Everybody has a problem, a major, at least one major problem that they're carrying around with themselves, that they're worrying about, that keeps them up at night. Each family, everybody's got it.
and which is bigger, you can't work out which is bigger than the other. All you know is that they're all different. No two people have got the same one. And that's where individuality comes.
How your particular tsar, how your particular hardship affects the way
without tsar. To go, or to make the question even more dramatic, does that mean we should go and look for trouble? Should we go and sell all our assets, not sell, give all our assets away, so that we should live in tsar? Levitin Shimon bar Chalasta seems to find kiddush with nothing in the pantry a pleasure, so maybe we should give away everything, donate it to a worthy cause, and try sitting next Shabbos with nothing. That we're not allowed to do that. So how do we achieve that same kind of pressure? Asks Rabbi Tzula. And he brings a beautiful Gemara. The Gemara is also well known, but the Tosfos on the Gemara is not well known, and the Tosfos is the gem. You know the story.
They asked Rabbi Eliezer, how far does one have to go in Kibud Av Ve'Em? Go and see what a goy did for his father. Goy in Ashkelon. The Domo ben Nesina Shemoy, his name was Domo ben Nesina. Bikshu mimenu chachomim avonim lo ifrit, b'shishim riboy, tzchar. The chachomim wanted a special stone, a precious stone, which he had, which cost 600,000 coins, whatever it was, gold coins. Enormous amount of money. They were prepared to pay for this one precious stone which they needed for the ephod for the Kohen Gadol. And the key for this cupboard in which Domo kept the precious stone was under his father's pillow and his father was asleep. The Lord Tziaro, and he turned the offer down. 60,000, 600,000 Krugerrands is not, what's that worth in money? 600,000, how much is it? $24 million. $24 million, that's real money. $24 million. He turned the offer down. $24 million. The Shono Acheres, Nelson HaKadosh Baruch Hu Schoro, next year the Ribbono Shel Olam repaid him. Shenoda, you see what happened, by the way, is it was a one-off offer. The Chachomim weren't prepared to wait, obviously. They must have had somebody else they could buy it for at the same price or whatever, and they weren't prepared to wait. The other offer maybe was about to expire, because he missed it. He didn't get that $24 million. But the next year, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him Schar, Shenoda Loi Pora Aduma Be'edra. Pora Aduma was born in his, a red heifer was born in his flock. Says Damo, I know what this poor Aduma is worth to you. I know I could ask all the money in the world and you would pay. All I want you to do is to compensate me for the money I lost when I didn't wake my father up. $24 billion for the cow is enough. Rabbi Chanina, and Rabbi Chanina used to add, a person who's not even obligated with a mitzvah of Kibud Av Ve'Em, it's only Derech Eretz for him, but it's not a mitzvah. Look how far he goes. How much more so we who are obligated to honor our parents? How much more so? Omer Rabbi Chia, because Rabbi Chia said, Godol mitzvah ve'isah mishayinah mitzvah ve'isah. A person who is obligated to do a mitzvah and does so is performing a greater deed than somebody who does it voluntarily. In the Western world, we're used to thinking that a voluntary act has more value than an obligated act. But that's not so. Chazal tell us that's not so. We believe that an obligated act is more valuable than a voluntary act. Omer Rav Yosef Mireish, Rav Amin Amandav, Omer Li Halokhe Kerab Yehuda, Doma Suma Potu Min HaMitzvahis, Avidno Yom HaTov El Rabon, Doholo Mifkedano, Vaho Avidno. Originally, I used to say that whoever will tell me that the Halokhe is like Rabbi Yehuda, that
that a blind man is potter from the mitzvah, that he's free from the obligation. Rav Yosef was blind. I used to be very happy and I would make a yom tov for such a man. I would have a suudas mitzvah. Because I'm blind, that means I'm not obligated to do the mitzvahs. And yet I do them. How much reward I must get for doing something voluntarily. Hashta de shmiyas lohod rabbi chamina, godol mitzvah v'yisa yosef mishayinu mitzvah v'yisa, hadarab, man d'omali, ein halochik rabbi yudha avidnu yom atava l'rabon. Now that I've heard rabbi chamina's halocha, that it's greater to do an act obligated than voluntary, now it's the opposite. If anybody tells me that we don't paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that a blind man is obligated to do the mitzvahs, then I do it, then I make a yom tov for him, then I'm very happy. Why is it, without going into the whole philosophy, why is it that an act of obligation is greater than an act of volition? Says Tosfos, an amazing thing. Godul ha-metzuvah v'ayse, nire dahaynu taymas. As Tosfos, it appears that the following is the reason. The mish ha-metzuvah v'ayse adif. A person who is obligated is preferred. Lefisha doyeg umitztayer yoyser pen yavu. Because he's worried about the possibility of not doing it right. Whereas the person who is not obligated has nothing to lose. He'll do it. If he doesn't do it, he doesn't do it. So what? No big deal. But a person who's obligated feels much more tense about it. He feels much, much more responsible about it. It's a completely different thing. If a person's practicing to walk a tightrope, and he puts the tightrope 6 feet, 6 inches above the floor, and he walks a tightrope, it's one type of walking the tightrope. The other one is, he puts it across the Niagara Falls or the Victoria Falls, and he walks the tightrope. Who's got more pachad? Who suffers more? Where's the suffering more? Of course, the person who walks across the Niagara Falls is suffering more. He's scared. He's got something to lose. The risks are big. It's true that at the end of it, he has more nachas. If he makes it, his rewards are much greater. That's exactly what it means. But the person who puts the 6 inches above the floor, it's the same skills. He didn't use any lesser skill than the person who walked across Niagara Falls. But there wasn't that urgency. If he falls, he falls. Not the end of the world. Nothing much to lose. When we've got an awful lot to lose, we're scared. And that fear is terribly important. It's an important part of the mitzvah. Why? L'flum tzairo igro. We are rewarded in accordance with our hardship. And the fear of Yiras Shamayim is the biggest hardship of all. The fear that the Ribbono Shel'Olam has an expectation and I might not manage. That's a fear. Says Rabbi Tzvi Peterburger, depending on the Yiras Shamayim, that will determine the tzair in a mitzvah. The fear, the worry of not performing, will be greater in the person who sees the Ribbono Shel Olam before him, who's aware of the Ribbono Shel Olam before him, and who fears failure. That will be much greater. You take a person, and you put him through a very difficult degree at university, he has to study very hard, and you give him a bursary, he gets 5,000 rand a year, or 10,000 rand a year, and you tell him at the end of it, if he fails after 3 years, he has to pay that back, 30,000 rand. If he passes, it's okay, you can keep it. And he goes through the 3 difficult years. It's a pachad. He's worried all the time. Is he going to make it? Is he doing enough work? Is he keeping? Is he doing his best? Serious. Take another person. You give him. Go to university for non-degree purposes. Go. You listen to the lectures. You can even write the exams. But it doesn't make any difference if you pass or fail. Absolutely no difference. Easy. Where's their more tzar? They're doing the same course. Same brain. Same mind. Same teachers. But the one who has something to lose has tzar, he suffers through the course, and the other one doesn't. Persons working in a secure job, working with the government, they'll keep you no matter what, until your retirement and pension, you're very comfortably, no matter what you do or don't do. Fine. So you work long hours, hard hours. It's difficult, fine, but you do it. Another person does exactly the same work, but is his own balabos. Or he's working on the strict understanding that if he doesn't perform, if he doesn't bring income in, he's out of a job. Where's there more tzar? Clearly, when there's more to lose, there's more tzar. But that's where there's more pleasure. That's where the hanoi is. And so says Rabbi Tzvi Peterburger, the greater the Yiras Shamayim, the greater the tzar. The greater the tzar, the greater the reward. And he adds that one of the areas that one has to be very careful about all this is in the area of learning Torah. Because other mitzvahs, let's say a person wakes up in the morning, is Mr. Davening. He's upset, he's Mr. Davening. He's about to get going, the phone rings, something happens, he goes here, he goes there. Before he looks around, it's already, his man Kriyashma is gone. He didn't say Kriyashma. He's about to get started, and something else happens, and the man Tefillah is gone. He hasn't davened. So he's missed the mitzvah of Kriyashma. Now he's missed the mitzvahs of Birkas Kriyashma. Again, he gets distracted before very long time for Shachris is over. Didn't daven Shachris this morning. And he goes into depression for the rest of the day. Terrible thing. But one word of Torah is more valuable than all the mitzvahs of the Torah together. One concept of Torah, to learn one halacha, one mishnah, one piece of Gemara, one parasha of Chumash Rashi, is much more valuable if you're going to wave mitzvahs up. Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Put all of them in one side, and the learning of Torah in the other side, and the learning of Torah outbalances them. How often do you find a person going into depression because he could have learned one word more today, and he didn't? Don't go into depression about that. Why? Asks Rabbi Tzvi Peterburg. The most important mitzvah of all. When we miss it, it doesn't bother us. Even if a whole day goes by that we didn't learn, then maybe we feel a little bit upset if we're used to learning every day. But let's not even talk about that. We did learn. But I could have learned an extra half hour and I didn't. I wasted the half hour. Not an onus. I wasted the half hour. Do I go into depression? I've missed it. No. My feeling is I'll make it up tomorrow. You don't realize you can't make it up tomorrow. It's gone forever. Why? Says Rabbi Tzvi, because we all look at the learning of Torah as if it's einu mitzvah v'oseh, as if it's not really obligatory. We look at it as something voluntary. Every minute we do learn, we think, nice of us, we pat ourselves on the back. Look. Why? Because there's no specific time for learning. It's not laid down, thou shalt learn from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock every morning. It doesn't say that. Doesn't say you shall learn 8 hours a day, 2 hours a day, 5 hours a day. It doesn't say that. Each person is left to learn as much as he can manage. And that creates an atmosphere, says the Bitzula, where we start regarding the mitzvah, voluntary mitzvah, as something that we do by free choice. So we learned only half an hour today, we pat ourselves on the back for the half hour we learned. We learned 2 hours, oh, today was a good day. You learned 4 hours today, an excellent day. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is not how much you learned today. The way to look at it is how much didn't you learn today. Was there any time today that you could have learned something new and you didn't? That you could have revised something old and clarified it in your mind? Was there any moment in the day that you missed? If there was, it's no better than missing Kriya Shema, than missing putting on tefillin, than missing a Shabbos. Imagine what would happen if you just forgot it was Shabbos. You remember Saturday night, you suddenly realize you've missed Shabbos. What a terrible thing it would be. But to miss an opportunity to learn Torah, we go, nothing serious. Miss a shir, miss a chavrusa, miss a few minutes of learning, doesn't bother us. Because we don't see ourselves as mitzvah v'oseh. We don't see this as obligatory. We see it as voluntary. And that creates a different atmosphere altogether. We don't have that yirah shamayim. We think when we're learning Torah, we're not walking over the Niagara Falls, where we've got a lot to lose. We think we're walking 6 inches above the floor. If I fall, good. I fall, not serious. And if I make it, very nice. I'll get a pat on the back for making it. It's not so. Limud HaTorah is no different to any other mitzvah. We're in fact walking across Niagara Falls in Limud HaTorah as well. And therefore, through the Yirah Shamayim that we're able to develop, to make the awareness of the Ribono Shel Olam real for ourselves, that enables us to feel a certain urgency in our living, a certain urgency in our Avedas Hashem, which makes it hard. But it's in that hardship that we become unique. It's in that hardship that each one develops his own level, because our levels of Yirah Shamayim are different. We're all putting on tefillin. We're all davening Shemoneh Esrei. We're all keeping Shabbos. We're all sitting in the same shir learning Torah. That our levels of Yirah Shamayim are different. And therefore the levels of pachad, the levels of fear, of worry, of concern, that we're not doing our best, differ from individual to individual. And it's those differences which make the difference. It's those differences which make each of us unique, which make each of us special. And that's the understanding of the Gemara in Brachos, where the Gemara speaks about what happens. You're having tzar, you don't know why. So the Gemara says you've got to seek and see what it is that you're doing wrong. And if you find that you're really doing nothing wrong, then you must assume that you're not learning enough Torah. And if you're checking, you are learning enough Torah, you're learning as much as you can, then you know that it's Yisurim Shel Ahava, says the Ribbono Shel, that's suffering of love. What does that mean? Says Rashi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Meyasroi Ba'olam Hazeh B'loi Shum Oven. The Ribbono Shel Olam sometimes punishes a person in this world without any sin at all. Kedei laharbois schoroi ba'olam habo yosei mechidei zechi yosef. So as to give you more reward in olam habo than you would otherwise have deserved. A human being cannot really deserve reward in olam habo, because whatever mitzvahs we do, they don't come near to the kindness which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. The only way that Ribbono Shel Olam can enable us to deserve our olam habo is to gear up our mitzvahs. If you go to a gym and they put you on a treadmill, you start and you go and you're walking and walking and walking and running on this treadmill, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, eventually, you know, how's it going? And the instructor comes and he takes your pulse, says, no, keep going, half an hour. Eventually you say to the good fellow, I don't have half an hour every day for this thing. You've got to find something else. Hey, he says, you're short of time, no problem. Tomorrow you come on the treadmill and he turns up the pressure, and after 3 minutes you're tired. And he says, just another half minute, 3.5 minutes, that's fine for today. What's he done? He's just geared it up. And the same action becomes much heavier, becomes much more valuable. That's what Yisurin Shel Ahava is. But the Ribbono Shel Olam takes a tzaddik and says, even if you do mitzvahs your whole life, I want those mitzvahs to be more valuable. And the way they can be more valuable is to perform those same mitzvahs against a backdrop of tzar, of difficulty, of hardship. Then those same mitzvahs can carry 100 times more reward for every mitzvah that you do. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam does with those people who are capable of handling it. He turns on the pressure to make the mitzvahs more valuable. If we're able to do it ourselves to a certain degree, the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't do it to us that easily. We're able to do it ourselves through the development of Yirah Shamayim, that if we find the fear of God in our mitzvahs, we find the fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam literally, that we see him, we're concerned about it, we're concerned about failing, about letting him down in any way, then the Ribbono Shel Olam counts those mitzvahs as mitzvahs performed under hardship, and the reward, the sense of accomplishment, the purifying consequence of the mitzvahs are in fact 100 times more than a mitzvah performed under comfort. We have to be very careful not to let go in life those special opportunities. And now and then, the instructor turns up the pressure a little bit. And now we've really got an opportunity to do a mitzvah. One comes home from work, and it's 5:25. Mincha's at 5:30. And one is tired out, absolutely exhausted. It's been a terrible day. One had to get up early that particular morning, and one has worked through the day without a stop, didn't have lunch, didn't have breakfast. All one has had is a glass of water during the day. One's hungry, tired, weak. Comes the question. Not even a shir tonight. Just chavrusa. Do I skip it or do I go? It shouldn't even be a shayla. The way to approach it is, when I'm feeling good, I can skip it. Yeah, it's only worth 100. But tonight I've got a chance to turn the pressure up. Tonight there's an opportunity in 1 hour to do 100 hours of Torah learning. In that 1 hour, it can be worth 100 hours. Is this something I give up? This is a golden opportunity to do a mitzvah. Those are the mitzvahs one grasps with both hands, and one performs with all one's heart and with all one's might.